You're listening to Spilling Ink.
Welcome to another live edition of Spilling Ink, the talk show that takes you behind the scenes in the publishing world. Tonight, I am here live from beautiful Sin City with our lovely host, Katie Salaitis.
Hi!
I know this is kind of trippy having us both on the same screen here. We are actually in the same location.
Crazy.
Geographically. It's pretty weird. with us tonight, we have Julia Lynn Rubin. How are you tonight, Julia?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, very good. And Julia's all the way out in New York, is that correct?
Yeah, I'm in Brooklyn.
Okay, how was the weather out there?
It's actually pretty nice. The weather was nice today. It was sunny and warmer, so it's getting better.
Excellent. I know my Michigan friends are suffering right now because it has been absolutely horrid. We are experiencing, I think, the fourth winter where it'll get warm. It'll get up to 50 degrees and we'll be excited and think that spring is here and then drop back down to, you know, 20 or 30 and dump some snow on us. So,
yeah, that's kind of what was going on with us. Like we had, it was like, I think it was last week on Monday, it was like a snowstorm, but then the snow melted in the same day and then it was raining and it was bizarre. So it's been very strange.
I won't even talk about our beautiful 80 degree weather over
here.
Oh,
yeah, it is. It's pretty much perfect out here. But this is like the last month of perfect,
yes,
right? Before it becomes 100 and some degrees and you can't leave the house.
Yeah, then it gets brutal.
Yeah. So, Julia, tell us a little bit about yourself. We know that you're a debut author. You just released your first book. Tell us about who you are and what you've written.
Okay, well, I graduated from the New School's MFA in Writing for Children and Young Adults program last year, and that was amazing, and that sort of cemented my decision to continue to write young adult. And I am a mentor for Girls Right Now, which is New York City's like premier mentoring program for high school girls, and they pair it with writing mentees. And I've always loved writing. I've always wanted to have a book out, like as a faraway dream, but like now I do, and this is it. This is the book from Diversion Books, and it came out on March 20th. And I'm 27. I'm going to be 28 next month, so I feel very fortunate because a lot of people start at different times in publishing, and I feel like I'm very young, so I feel very lucky.
Well, for sure, and I don't think that. When did I start? I think I was 30 or 31 before I sat down and actually seriously wrote that first novel. And yeah, you're getting in at a good time where you've got lots of years that you can produce cool fiction.
That's amazing.
Tell us a little bit about Borough Hills.
Borough Hills was pitched as The Outsiders meets Perks of Being a Wallflower. That was sort of our comp pitch. It is about a 17-year-old boy who lives in this kind of rundown town in Southern California. And he just like sort of bums around with his friends. He doesn't really have a lot of life goals. And he's surrounded by toxic masculinity, which is a theme that arose in the revision and editing process that I've noticed. And but then this new boy comes to town, this like new confident cool boy, and they sort of start this secret romance, and it kind of sets into motion a chain of other things, and things kind of come crumbling down, part of it because they're together, but mostly because of my main character's name is Jack, and mostly because of his own like paranoia and anxiety, and he's hiding that he's gay and he's terrified of it. So that's a very strong theme in the book.
Okay.
So let's touch on that toxic masculinity for a second. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah. Toxic masculinity is kind of this idea that men have to act a certain way. You have to fit into like the be a man box, like don't show emotion, don't cry, provide for your family, be a father. Like there's all of these, like stringent rules, and it puts so much pressure on young boys, but also adult men. And it damages them in so many ways. Just these rules we enforce on men, these sort of unspoken rules. And yeah, I'm not like an expert on toxic masculinity. It's interesting because when my publicist pitched me to do like an article for a site, they were like, does she have a PhD? Is she a sociology professor? And I was like, no, it's just something I know about. But yeah, it's sort of the way that our culture, it's the way that our culture puts stressors on boys and men to act a certain way.
It's okay. Absolutely true though. absolutely, 100%. You know, as a mom of a small boy right now, I see it in little things that we do. You know, if he wears pink or if he wants to play dress up. Already at this age, you know, there's that you shouldn't be doing that. You're a boy.
Yeah.
Which I don't care. I mean, if he wants to wear a pink bow, let him wear a pink bow. I could care less.
Right. Or like even when parents make comments like, oh, he's a looker. Better watch out, girls. Like there's that sort of subtle reference to that because it's like the gender role is he's going to go out and pursue women. And we don't know that, you know, when they're their kids, but not, but that is part of it. So.
Now your character, has he always known he was gay or is this something that he's discovering within the book?
You know, I think that's a good question. I feel like part of him has always known, but never confronted it. I think like when you are LGBTQ, like I am bisexual. Like I always kind of knew, but I didn't know if that makes sense. Like, I think there was this kind of understood, I knew like deep down, but I didn't really admit it to myself until my 20s or like fully come to terms with it. So I think that's where he is. And throughout the book, he's kind of coming to terms with it because he's been like blocking it out and like, no, this doesn't matter. I don't feel this. This isn't real. And now he's like, okay, I think I am. But his, it's not just a coming out story, but I mean, it is a part of the book.
Okay. And I think the idea of toxic masculinity and not just the idea, I mean, the reality of toxic masculinity would be especially hard on a young man who's gay and kind of learning how to accept that about himself and how to go on into the world, knowing that and trying to be who he is without, I don't know, what's the right word, without feeling ashamed or without feeling like he has to hide his identity.
Yeah, you feel like a failure already without even having done anything wrong.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing is that he does not live in a very supportive community. It's not like a very open, and his family is not, I'm not like forthright about being supportive. His dad's, you can tell his dad might not be okay with it if he found out. His mom, maybe. His friends use a lot of homophobic slurs, and the way they talk about women is disgusting. And so he's terrified. And I think another thing is because he's 17, I wanted to capture that when you're a teenager, like you think everyone's looking at you. You think everything you do matters. You know, you wear the same outfit twice. It's like, oh my God, everyone thinks I'm, you know, this and that. And he's just paranoid, really. He's so anxious that all eyes are on him. And if he shows any sign of any being in a relationship with this other guy, that something horrible is going to happen.
There's too.
and he's not wrong per se, because there are like one of his best friends is quite homophobic. But I think it more comes from being intimidated by this new guy. And like, that's my friend. And there's a possessiveness going on that's not romantic, but yeah, I think it comes out in a homophobic way. He expresses it that way. So yeah, I mean, you're not in an environment where everyone's like, by the way, if you are, I love you anyway. No one said that. No one's ever said that. It's sort of this unspoken rule that like, you got to be a guy and go get girls and, you know.
Well, and you know, I have a son who's actually an adult now. He's 19 and he's always been a very sensitive kid. He's got a lot of emotions, both good and bad, you know, and you have a very sensitive son as well. So you understand. And, it's growing up without naming any names, people very close to our family, people that love our family and our kids, have even made kind of nasty remarks to us or remarks in jest about, you know, well, is he gay or is he this or that? And I'm like, you know what?
Who cares?
That really doesn't matter. And it's whenever people say things like that, they always say it in a way that makes it look like they're joking around or makes it look like it's not a big deal.
But the negative overtone is there.
Yes. And just like when your friend who is not a racist makes that casual racist joke and then says, oh, but you know me, I'm not a racist. Like, you know, you are, you know, don't do that. Don't say that kind of shit, you know?
I mean, there is a school of thought that I tend to agree with, that jokes are never just jokes. And every joke we make is sort of a coded message. It's sort of a, it's wanting to share something that's taboo or strange, or you think other people are going to be weirded out by. So you create a joke. That's just one. I think that would fall into that category. And the other thing is, it's kind of inherently like, why it's inherently putting gay in a bad category. Like, oh, is he gay? It's othering him. And also suggesting that if he were, it would be bad and different and weird and other. And then there's a stereotype on top of it. So it's like, it's a whole mess. Like, no matter, even if it is a joke, it's a really bad joke.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
It's not even clever.
Yeah. Now, yeah.
Oh. Go ahead.
Now, you said that you recently, or I'm not sure if it was recently, do you say in your 20s that you accepted that you were bisexual? Is that right?
Yeah. When I was in my early 20s, I think I like sort of fully came out to myself.
Was that something that was, did you have a difficult time coming out with that? Or did people around you already kind of know? Were they accepting, or was it hard for you?
You know, it's funny because I've always been the biggest ally and advocate for LGBTQ rights and issues, and I'm super accepting of all my friends and family. But for some reason, I was so terrified. Like, even though my family is so supportive, and nobody had any idea, I don't think. Like, I, you know, people thought I was straight. I mean, I presented straight when I would, like, talk about, you know, boyfriends and guys, and I didn't really have any indication. So I think that it was just scary for me. I don't know why. It was almost like an internalized thing, I think. An internalized negativity. But it wasn't hard with friends and family, but even saying it out loud to you guys, like on air, on camera, I still get nervous. I don't understand why. Like, I always get anxious. I think it's because when you say that, you know you're othering yourself, for better or for worse. And you also know that people are going to judge you and make assumptions about you because they're putting a label on you. And even if you don't think the label is negative, or you think it's fine, or you don't care, you know, you are admitting to the world that here's my label. And I think that's why a lot of people say, I don't like labels, is because they don't like a word being associated with them that other people can then judge them on. So it wasn't difficult in terms of friends and family. It was just more myself. I always felt like, oh, this is weird.
Yeah. Following up on that, how has the reception to your book been?
It's been really positive so far. I mean, I don't have a super wide reception yet because it's an indie and it didn't get like a super huge pre-release promo. But so far, most of the reviews from casual readers and fellow authors have been really, really positive. So I'm very happy about that.
Okay. Now you said you're an indie, but I think before you said you also worked with a publishing company. Can you tell us a little bit about your publishing journey, how you got connected with your publisher?
Well, my publisher is an independent publisher, but they're a traditional publisher. So that's what I associate with indie, is like a traditional house that does the brick and mortar and the distribution. They do it through Ingram. And I have an agent, and my agent negotiated the contract. So it's very traditional in that sense, but it's indie in the sense that it's like, they're smaller. They're not part of the big five. They're not an imprint of HarperCollins or Simon & Schuster. And so, and they're also not like a bigger indie house like Scholastic or even like Albert Whitman or Skyhorse, but they're small. So, I mean, I found them through my agent pitched the book to them when we were going on submission. She pitched it to the big five, obviously, and a lot of different editors. She pitched it very widely, but Diversion was the publisher that was like, we want this and we love this. And I think because my book is not super commercial, it's not super high concept, especially at the time we were sending it out, that seemed to be a problem for some houses. I think that because Diversion's smaller, they can take risks on books that might not be as big and exciting, and they can afford to like sign authors that, you know, they're not sure like if they're going to sell well, but they're generally passionate about. And you can do that at bigger houses, but I think that was one benefit to going with them.
Okay.
And that's
now,
how
did you find your agent?
I queried. I went in the query trenches, as they call them. I did a lot of research on how to query, how to write a query letter, synopsis. I went through tons of revisions. I went on forums and I learned as much as I could. I read books. I honestly learned, like, I kind of did a mini master's in publishing with myself. Cause I just wanted to do it correctly and I didn't, but I tried. I kind of made a list of agents and then I ended up just sort of querying everybody, which is not how you're supposed to do it. You're supposed to like do it in sections and have like a spreadsheet or, you know, but I did it in my own messy way. And eventually, after 8 months, my now agent, she signed me. So, and it happened fairly quickly because she's like, oh, I didn't get to read this in, as I sent it to her like March of 2015. And then in August, I get an email and she's like, do you still have the full? Can I read it? And I had fulls out with a few other agents or partials at the time. And I was like, okay. And for some reason, I just kind of had a feeling she would want my book. Like from the second I saw her photo and her info on her agency page, I just like knew. But like, I didn't hear from her for a while. So I was like, okay, maybe she's not interested. But she read the full in like several days and then was like, I want to talk about representation. And it happened very quickly. So that's how I found her. It's just a lot of research, a lot of rejections, a lot of rejections, a lot, like a lot of full requests. And then this isn't for me or full requests. And I don't think you're a YA writer or various things like that. I got all kinds of feedback. And I was honestly convinced for a while that I would not sell this book, that I would not get an agent. I was like, okay, I'm going to try anyway, though.
Awesome. Now, what did you do for your book release? Did you have Facebook parties or what did you do to generate interest for the big release? Because it was just a month ago, right?
It was. I actually had a launch event at a bookstore called Powerhouse on 8th in Brooklyn. And I had friends and family come and it was really, really great. I went to the Teen Author Festival that David Levithan hosts every year. And it brings together like hundreds of YA authors to do like panels and symposiums. And it was fun. I did a few events for that. And I basically did like, I kind of set up my own events. And I did like the week after my book came out, I did another bookstore event. And again, it's just friends and family who come to these things, but it's still, and then I had a few blog, I was a guest blogger on a few blogs, or I had like YA and Tarot Bang did a few things with me. So it was like a mix of online and in person.
Now going forward, do you have a marketing plan for your book to continue the momentum?
Not exactly. It's kind of hard because I mean, I have a publicist who I'm working with and they're working really hard. My house is working hard to push the book as it continues. I know they're nominating it for things and they're pushing for, we really need trade reviews, I think is the big thing right now, because when a book gets a trade review, it's just taken seriously in a different way, I think, especially in an indie release. And it's harder for small press books to get trade reviews for some reason. It can be. So, but I'm trying to focus on libraries right now because I know that bookstores can only carry so many titles due to money and, you know, they want to sell. So if they're not going to have random things on the shelf, they don't really know about. So I'm really focusing on libraries and I'm going to do more events if I can. And hopefully school visits. I'm actually meeting with someone next week about a school visit organization in New York. And yeah, I think I'm just going to wing it like I do with everything. There's no like real plan. I found that a lot of like online stuff doesn't necessarily work. Like you can be a guest poster somewhere, but people don't necessarily get excited unless they like hear you reading or they have a specific connection to your book or somebody recommends it to them. So I'm hoping word of mouth will help me too.
Live events do tend to get more readers and more new readers than the online stuff. But for a lot of authors, the ebook is where they're mostly selling at. They're selling less in the physical stores, more online. So I know you said you're going after libraries. Are you also targeting any kind of marketing for the Kindle store, the Nook store, anything like that?
I would love to, if you have advice on what I should be doing. I honestly don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. I think like I'm in a debut group right now. And I think most of us feel that way because you're not really given direction. They're just like, okay, here you go. Here's your book. And here's a plan. But they don't say, okay, on this day you do this. And on this day you do this. So if you have any advice, I would love to hear it. If you have a spreadsheet for me.
Nah, I love that, the spreadsheet. There's honestly, it's never one size fits all. And from right. every author that we've talked to, they all have a slightly different method of going about advertising their books, marketing, being online. And so that's why we kind of asked the question to see, you know, how you're approaching it, because yours will probably be different than everybody else's.
Yeah. I mean, I found that for me, like, I don't like to spam people with stuff. Not that other people do that per se, but I don't like to just say like, my book, go buy it. I would rather just immerse myself in the YA community online, which I absolutely love. And I'm a mentor with Author Mentor Match, which is so much fun. And it's sort of like Pitch Wars, but it pairs aspiring authors with agented writers who are either published on submission or in revision. And I try to just be active on Twitter and with my debut group and support other authors. And I think like that's sort of how I want to do it. I'm not a very self-promotional person. I'd rather like have genuine connections. And if somebody's interested in my book, cool. Yeah, I thought about making a book trailer and I might eventually, but I know they don't sell books. So I don't know about that.
It's really tough. You know, I think a long time ago, the very first time Katie had me on this show, it was as a guest. And I think mm-hmm. it might have been the very first show.
Yeah, you were on, our first episode.
And her and David had asked me what my marketing plan was. And I had told her at the time, my plan is that I have no plan. And I really didn't. And what I found over the years is that, one, I really need to have a better plan than that. But two, I don't know what the hell that plan is supposed to be yet. You know, I have tried a lot of different things, and I really think that a lot of it comes down to the overall book buying market, having a great cover for your book and having a little bit of luck.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of back into a place myself now where a little bit like what you described, where I'm just trying to chat with people and be myself and talk to people and hopefully make some connections. And if they're interested in a book, then great. But I'm certainly not putting all my stock in selling a whole bunch of books, because I don't sell a ton of books, but I do have a good time writing them. And I think that the people that read them enjoy them. And I think that's good enough, as long as everyone is having an enjoyable time and not stressing out too much about it.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I mean, it's so intrinsically rewarding for me, not only to write, but to be published. So it's like, yes, I want to make money and have an income from writing. Of course, everyone does. But at the same time, like, I really want to write a bunch of books. I want to publish endless books my whole life. So I guess my marketing plan is to just keep publishing books, and then people will find my first book, and then it'll sort of build on itself. Because I don't just want to ever write one novel and then I'm done. And I think part of it is just to keep writing. I think that is always a good, because people tend to be like, what can I do to make this book big? And I'm like, there's not a lot you can do. Like, unless you're like a big, like, frontlist title, or your publisher's putting like a ton, but even then sometimes that doesn't work out. So it's like, you kind of just have to keep writing, and then kind of your audience will hopefully find you, and then they'll follow you and you engage with them. And then they'll be like, when are you writing something else? Can I read your next thing? And I think it builds on itself that way. So I know, like, John Green's first book, he was not super famous right away, but he was very active on social media and YouTube, and he had a channel, I think, with his brother. And a lot of his readers came from his YouTube fans. And I see authors like Kim Chance doing that, and I think it's brilliant. It's like they're doing like an interesting, informative show online, but then they're like, I have a book, by the way. And I think that's a really smart marketing plan, is to do multiple things.
Mm-hmm. Being real with your audience, that's a thread that we've heard a lot from various authors we've talked to, because it does kind of feel like spam, like you said, when people are just saying, you know, buy my book, by the way, I have a book, do you want to read my book, see my book, here's my book over here. Yeah. And it does become repetitive and annoying, and you have to find another way to say, hey, I'm out there, but I'm also a real person too.
Right. And I think, like, I have unfollowed people who do nothing but spam their books. I think we all have. It's just, like, I'm sure it's great, but, and everyone's to be read pile is so long, you know, like, it's also hard to get people to prioritize your book, because they might be interested in reading it, but they might read it like a year from now or 2 years from now, or you know, there's so many books. It's like, how do you get them to pick up yours first? I still don't know. I think luck is a big part of it. And I think word of mouth too. If you hear your friend raving about a book, you're more likely to buy it and read it than if you hear a stranger raving.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, and my to-be-read pile is longer than I will ever read in my lifetime.
Yeah.
I have picked up so many books from author friends and books for that are that went on freebie and were advertised on Facebook or Twitter that, I've clicked on. And, you know, I think you made a good point there. It might take me 3 years to get to read The Tree Maker, which is somewhere on my Kindle, even though it's got an awesome title and that's why I downloaded it. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's not a long time because I'm the consumer. It's there on my Kindle or it's there on my bookshelf waiting for whenever. But for the author, we might be every day like, oh, when are they going to read it? When are they going to leave their review and going a little nuts?
I mean, I do not know a single friend or family member who has finished my book yet so far, and it's been out for not a full month, obviously a few weeks, but everyone's like, oh yeah, I'll get to it. And I don't take it personally because I'm the same way. I have so many books that I'm so excited about. We have so little time and it's like you gotta pick one or two at the same time. So yeah, I as long as someone adds it to their pile, I'm happy because that means they're thinking of me.
Yeah, for sure. Right. Now how did you go from your idea for this book to actually writing it?
That's a good question and sort of an interesting question because I never like set out to make this a book in the beginning. It sort of started out as just a concept. It was like a series of vignettes, like slices of life, it's sort of how I write. I have to force myself to create plot. It's not my strong suit. I like to write weird little scenes and then weave everything together in the end. I write out of order. So I just had this really strong image, this sense of place. And then the character sort of developed and then I kept working on it. And eventually I was like, okay, I'm going to make this into a book, but it never was like me setting out like, okay, I'm going to write a book about this and this is the main character. And it just sort of naturally evolved and a lot of procrastination too. That contributed a lot.
Procrastination is awesome. I'll tell you what, it really is. No, that then the first book that I wrote too, I was so intimidated by the idea of writing a book. I had wanted to write a book since I was like 10.
Yeah.
I always wanted to be an author. I wanted to be like my heroes. But I never thought it would actually happen because I was scared to death of the commitment. And so I had the house we lived in. We experienced some really freaky paranormal things going on. The most notable of which was this little girl wearing a white dress that would just kind of appear in different places in the house and scare the shit out of us. And so I was like, you know, I told my wife, I was like, we're going to have to write a story about this. And so all I had were these little actual experiences, these little vignettes, as you said, and they ended up getting put together into the book, The Cold Room. But I'm kind of the same way where I don't really have a plot, so to speak. I will just know that, okay, I want these five cool things to happen somewhere in the story and then try to fit it all together. So I would take it that you're a pantser then, or do you have some kind of broad outline?
Well, I never really have. So I sometimes have a physical outline, like maybe halfway through the book's development because I need it. But usually I have an outline in my head, a very rough idea of where I'm going, what I want. And I often have the ending before I have most of the middle because I like having a goalpost and I like everything adding up to something. So even if I don't have a concrete idea of the ending, I like saying, okay, at the end of the book, she's going to do this. That's the resolution. But how do I get there? So I'm definitely a pantser. I'm a very messy writer. People are always like, how do you write out of order? I'm like, how do you write in order? It's so hard.
I like how you touched on the topic, though, of being intimidated by the writing a book. Because a lot of people look at a book and they're like, 80,000 words. How the hell am I going to write 80,000 words? And they don't think about, you know, just doing little bits at a time. Like, for instance, you said you write little vignettes. But even for a linear writer, which I'm a very linear writer, I have to write in order. If you take 1,000 words a day and you just give that as a goal, you're going to have more than enough material within a few months to create a book. And then it's just a matter of cleaning house.
I mean, Yes, theoretically, but...
That's right, theoretically.
What happens is that the self-talk... Well, this is what happens for me, is that I start out really excited, doing exactly what you're saying, very dedicated, and then I hit the, oh, I don't know what I'm doing. And I'm conscious of every word, and I'm self-editing as I'm writing, and I get into, and I'm like, well, I don't know what to do. So, especially because I read out of order, but I'm trying to, there's a project in the future I want to work on where I'm going to force myself to write linearly because it's part of, it's a retelling. So I'm like, okay, I have to just follow the plot.
But you said something though, that's very important. Self-editing.
Oh, I self-edit constantly.
This is what I tell every writer I meet, or every wannabe writer who says, oh, I can't do it. All right, your first draft is supposed to suck. Drill that into your head. Your first draft is always supposed to suck. So if you understand that, shut up. If you...
By the way, I'm going to get my plug. I'm going to get my plug in because my battery is low, but I'm listening. Uh-oh. I'll be right back. Keep talking.
The echo's back.
How did the echo come back?
Not the echo.
You left the spotlight and the echo came back. That's good. I wonder what she's doing back there.
I'm getting my
Yeah, that's right. She's getting the power cord.
All right, so let's see what happens. Do you hear the echo? I don't hear the echo. Okay, so back to what I was saying. All right, so if you understand and accept the fact that your first draft is supposed to suck, and you allow yourself to have a sucky first draft, then all you're doing when you're sitting down to write that 1,000 words a day as your goal is just word spewing. You don't care if it's great. You don't have to have it be perfect. All you're doing is getting the idea onto the page.
Yeah.
If you can stop yourself from self-editing, you can really bang out more than 1,000 words a day very easily. And then you come back and you clean house. But you only clean house once the story is complete. It's a crappy first draft, and that's fine. You collect it, you finish it up later. But you have to make sure there's a story to polish before you start going in and self-editing, because that will stop you, and it will make your writing time 10 times longer every time.
It's such good advice. I don't think I'm ever going to ever stop self-editing to an extent, because what will happen is I will write a few sentences and then go, ooh, let me fix that and I'll tweak it. But that actually helps me keep writing, because sometimes I do what you're saying and I just stream of consciousness, but that sometimes I'll sit there and think for a second. And then like, it's like when a songwriter's like singing to themselves, I'll like talk to myself and then I'll go back and read what I just wrote and end up editing a little bit. So I don't think self-editing is always bad. I think it's like everyone has a different process, and for me it can be helpful, but it's definitely not helpful when all you're doing is self-editing and you're not writing. And it's just, you know, I can't do this. But I think the paralysis is very normal. I'm experiencing it with the third book I'm working on right now. I know the ending, and yet because I have to thread everything together, that's where I'm struggling. I'm like, well, how does this scene connect to this scene? And I just sit there like, I'm going to watch Netflix. Like I can't work on it.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I'm like, well, this is too much.
Yeah. And I'll get there too, where I have no idea what that connective tissue is supposed mm-hmm. to be. And every once in a while I will bitch and complain about it to my wife, and she'll be like, just, can't you just leave it blank or just not put that scene in there? And I'll be like,
just yeah. watch a movie and there's a blank scene where the director's like, sorry, no footage found. There you go.
But you know, funny enough is, sometimes you don't have to lead the reader along like they're on a leash. You don't have to have every single little piece of information in front of
them. That's true.
Because our readers are smart. I mean, that's why they're reading books, is because they're smart and they want their brains to work. Mm-hmm. And so if you're giving them enough information that a reasonably intelligent person who's reading your book can follow along, you might not need to have all those extra little details that maybe you didn't think of. And a lot of times you're just kind of getting yourself whipped up into a little stress cyclone for nothing. And that doesn't mean I don't do it, because I still do it. And speaking of self-editing, since I've been working with the new publishing company, and they are super, super stringent about how they want their sentences and their paragraphs structured, I have actually been self-editing as I go, but I'm not going back to like the previous pages in self-editing. It's okay. Just line by line. I have to be conscious, because editing the last book that they went through and tore up was brutal. It was horrible. It was like complete rewrite nearly. So you do need to be self-editing, taking up all your time. Yes, it's a bad thing, but at the same time, being conscious of what you're throwing out there. For some of us, well, obviously not for a master wordsmith
For those intimidated by the fact that you're looking at an 80,000 word mountain to climb.
Yeah.
That is where the advice of don't self-edit, just get it out there helps, because then it takes away that stress of getting to the end. You're just little simple goals, word dump for today. And then once you've gotten there and you've gotten that massive pile of words, then you clean it up. Yeah. Now, it's not for everybody, but it does help those people who are intimidated by the fact that they've got this huge pile to go to.
And I may give her shit, but Katie publishes 3 to 4 books a year.
On average.
She actually does know what she's talking about. So her advice on just getting the words out is very good advice. And in fact, if you are a fan of reading books on writing, a lot of the masters of the craft will tell you, just get your words down.
And you never know what gem you're going to produce when you're just spewing words out. I have little documents I call like my sketch pages, my sketchbook, because I always need an analogy, I guess. But I'm just sort of like, I will do this thing where I have the rhythm of the sentences, but they don't make sense. It's sort of like when a singer ad-libs, and I'll just write these bizarre, nonsensical, and this is when I go straight into my subconscious. And I did this recently and it really helped. I'll do this weird, the sentences don't make sense, the words, it'll just be like this and this and that, this and this and that, and I'll have a rhythm. And then I'll go back and write the real sentences and I'm like, oh, I just outlined, but like in a weird way, but it worked. Because it got rid of the self-editor, because I was like, okay, but it literally can be gibberish shorthand that you understand. And I have a friend who's an amazing writer. She writes in shorthand before she drafts often. And I think it's brilliant because she has her own, she's just like idea, idea, idea. And that way you can really get on the page without worrying about, is it grammatically correct? Does it sound good? Is it authentic? Does the dialogue work? And I think that, yeah, I love the shorthand strategy. I'm going to keep doing it. It's fun.
Well, I think that's actually a great idea. Because then you're getting the meat of it down, or maybe not the meat of it, but you're getting the core ideas down, which is what you need to remember.
Like writing notes.
And yeah, exactly. And then you just go and fill in later. I like that. Mm-hmm. I like that
idea. It's like a to-do list idea.
Yeah.
I'm not outlining. I'm just writing a basic to-do list for my character.
Yeah, you're just writing images and ideas and thoughts and blah, 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 blah. And then when you go back and read it, you're like, oh, I know what I was thinking because it's yours. So you get it. Kind of like when you read your own notes, you usually understand what you wrote.
As long as I don't handwrite them.
Yeah.
I have terrible, terrible handwriting. So like signing books for me is always like, I just do my initials. It's a lot. Or I say like, hi, person. Everybody has these like beautiful little epigraphs they put, and I can't do it. I'm going to mess it up.
Oh, I know. I hate that when people expect you to write some brilliance and you're just like, happy reading.
Write me a long note. I'm like, because my handwriting's bad. And you'll be like, well, you didn't write this neatly. And I'll be like, well, I can't.
Everyone wants a personalized note.
And I know.
No offense to anyone out there who wants a personalized note from me, because I've had many people ask me.
It's 50 cents extra.
I just don't always have something to say. I'm not brilliant all the time. My editor is brilliant. Yeah. That's where that comes
there
from.
There you
okay?
go. Yeah.
So I will write, enjoy the reading. And scribble. So,
I just write hi. I mean, I would like to personalize things. I feel like if you're personalizing every single book, it's not special because it's like a stock personalization. I'd rather personalize it when I know the person really well and I have something to say. But yeah.
You know what was kind of interesting about the personalizations? Now, one of my writer crushes is Victoria Schwab, V.E. Schwab. She writes young adult.
Love her.
Yes, just fabulous, wonderful.
Very nice author. Lady too, by the way.
Yeah, super nice. And I went to a book signing with her and two other authors. I think it was just last summer. Heather and I went out there, and I bought her book at the store. It was at Schuller's Books, I think. And gosh, I can't even remember the name of the lady sitting next to her. Anyhow, I bought all their books and I was going to have them all sign them. And the young lady that was the other author that was signing next to Schwab was asking me if I wanted a personalization for the book. And I didn't know who I was going to give the book to at that time. It was a young adult book, and I thought I might give it to my daughter, Abigail. And I was like, no personalization. That's fine. And she was like, why? That way it makes it easier for you to sell on eBay if you don't like it. And I was like,
You're not paparazzi asking for celebrity autographs.
Right?
I mean, she's pretty famous, but...
That's kind of rude for an author to say something like that.
And it wasn't Victoria that had said that. It was the other author that was up there signing with her. And I thought it was really kind of strange. And it might have just been a weird, dry sense of humor kind of thing.
Probably. He or she probably meant it as a joke. But, like, you're standing there, like, in front of these authors, and you're like, yeah. What did I do? I'm sorry. Like,
really, I'm not trying to be an asshole. I just
I don't want to meet out to me
if I'm going to give it to my kid.
I suspect that's another instance of like a coded joke where it's like, I'm joking, but not really. Is that what you're doing?
Yeah. Because
they probably have experience with that. And they probably are. I wouldn't say that to someone because that's like, they bought the book. At least they bought it.
Right? Yeah, right? That's all you care about. You bought it? Yay!
I mean, my book's not big at all, and I'm already seeing it show up on free download sites. And I'm just like, oh, okay, well, at least someone bought it first.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's nothing I can do.
Well, and you can spend a lot of time hunting and or tracking all that stuff down and sending out your cease and desist letters. And honestly, I really don't pay any attention to it.
It doesn't matter.
If you're watching and thinking about
it matters, but
ripping my book onto some site, I will find it.
Maybe. Blasty. Look up Blasty.
Blasty.
It's an automated service that's supposed to do it for you. Now, I don't know how well they do it, but they're supposed to be searching out all the copies of your book. And
okay.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I'm famous enough to do cease and desist letters.
I don't have the energy for
that. I use
up all my energy just going to work and playing on Facebook after work. I don't have energy for searching for stolen
copies. Just spending 3 hours a day when you could be writing.
You could be writing. Did you break this chair again?
I'm trying to break your husband's chair again. I mean, I'm not. All right. I'm just a little shorter now.
Ooh, I feel tall all of a sudden for once in my life. Yeah, the cease and desist letter, you could spend a lifetime on those. It's not really worth doing. And even that service, that Blasty that I was telling you about, you still have to set it up. So you still have to go through the motions. So it's kind of like, if you want to, do it. If not, you know, so be it.
I just want people to read it. And there's a part of me where I can hear my echo again. I think it's gone now. No, I hear myself. Sorry. It's just, it distracts me.
It's really distracting.
But there's also a part of me that sees it and I'm just like, oh, well, someone's reading it. Someone wants to read it. Cool. Give me an Amazon review. You know, you didn't pay for it, but give me a review and we're fine.
See, the reviews, that's the important thing. Getting those actual reviews, not just from readers, but like you said, from the trade publications too.
Yeah.
Now, because we're trying to reach a wide audience of from complete newbies into the writing world to seasoned professionals, when we're talking about trade reviews, what are we talking about for everybody else?
We're talking about major reviewers that have a lot of influence, like School Library Journal, Kirkus Reviews, anything that if you get a star, it's like you can put that on your front cover and be like, a starred Kirkus review, like that's a big deal. And trade reviews give you more exposure. They give your book more exposure, especially to librarians. And all of those like ALA nominations, American Library Association Awards, having a trade review helps like get librarians' attention and then maybe more librarians buy your book. This is just from what I know. But yeah, trade reviews, it's sort of like getting, it's like it's industry recognition. And not all trade reviews are positive. I know some of my fellow debuts who have like, oh my God, I just got this horrible trade review. What do I do? And we're like, find the really little good part and then use that. There's like one good part. I'm in a situation where it's like, I really want a trade review because I want more exposure for my book and I want librarians to learn about it. But I also am not worried about negative trade reviews right now. So I'm kind of lucky in that sense. I don't have like this was the worst book I've ever read on Kirkus. So I'm, but they're helpful. They're very helpful.
It reminds me of that Captain Jack meme, you know, where this is, you're the worst pirate I've ever heard of, but you have heard of me.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, but you did write a review.
Yes. And I've used that meme many times. I love it. But you have read my book.
That's it. It's all that matters.
I've got your 99 cents, damn it. So now, talking about reviews and talking about negative, mm-hmm. have you experienced any trolling yet with your work? I know it's only been out about a month now. Have you had any real negative feedback yet?
I've had a couple people that the book wasn't for them, but no, I haven't had any trolls. I think part of like not being very well known is the benefit is like you don't have thousands of troll, like bad reviews or people who didn't read it or people who, I don't know. I haven't dealt with trolling yet. I've seen it. I've seen it happen to other authors.
It's pretty horrific at times. And we spoke last week about this, about mm-hmm. Authors and reviewers behaving badly and how in one instance a graphic designer just, you know, about a month ago was driven to the point of attempting to commit suicide by people who had been trolling her terribly. The reason I asked is because in our new administration, the climate of our country has been much more conservative, and you've published a book that is very not conservative. And so I was wondering, when you put this out, were you concerned at all about any negative backlash, you know, writing a LGBTQ book for young adults? Or did you just kind of say, hey, you know, I wrote the story that I want to write and that's how it's going to be?
I want them to ban my book so bad. Like, that's one of my dreams.
That is a badge of honor, though.
I want either Mississippi or Alabama, one of those states. I know that's a stereotype, but I want one of them to, like, the one school district to get really mad. But it's not in the National Library, so again, who knows. But number two, the second thing you listed, I was like, I'm writing this book for the kids that need to read it. For whatever reason, whatever it is they relate to it, whether they're LGBTQ or not, whether they have anxiety or family problems or they're dealing with addiction or whatever it is in the book that speaks to them, or they want to leave their small town. That's what I care about, is the kids that read the book that need to read it. I know it's not for everybody. I know I'm a little bit of like a niche writer. My writing style is kind of weird. But
what's weird about your writing style?
I mean, I don't think this first book is super weird, but I always have like weird magical realism elements and like can get very literary and, I have really weird offhanded things, like scenes that don't, people are always like, what was the point of that? And I was like, just go with it. Like, it makes sense to me. but like, I do it intentionally. Like, I'll put in these weird, odd details because I like the way, I like the, how that makes you feel. I like the subtext in books and I like the strange little nuances. But people, don't, some people are just like, I don't understand this. And I'm like, that's cool. Like, just read it. But this book isn't super weird, but I do have kind of a weird scene where my main character, Jack, is on the strip and he's very observational. He makes a lot of, he notices a lot of things. He's also very sensitive and he kind of just takes the whole world in and is very visual. And there's a scene with this man who's like selling knives on a baby blanket that I actually... it's like an homage to Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark by Alvin Schwartz. I don't know if you remember that series. Everybody does. And the original illustrations, I have all three of them with the original illustrations.
Oh, sweet.
And that was an homage to that. And it's a weird scene. And I kind of wove it in somehow. But I remember in the first draft my editor read, she was like, what is the point of this? And I was like, and I sort of finagled it and made it work because it was supposed to be more of like a, I don't know how to explain it. I'm kind of weird. So, but it's in the book, but it's definitely an homage to a horror story. And it has nothing to do with the plot. It's just sort of like kind of reflecting what the character's going through. Yeah. But that's not, I feel like, especially in when you're working in the industry, people are not always receptive to subtle nuances like that. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're just like, we don't get it. Take it out. And that's the challenge.
Yeah, and I think that's the difference, too, with working with a small press publisher is mm-hmm. you can actually kind of communicate that this is something that you want to have in there, whereas a larger publisher is going to say that's gone, you know. because their editors are going to do that without you having any say in it. But yeah, and I completely understand. I have several weird little things that I put into each of my books, and I'm not going to say what they are because I like it when people just find these little hidden gems,
little Easter eggs.
Yes, exactly. Just okay, little things that mean something to me, and they're fun. A good editor would probably chop them out, but
well, not necessarily, because I think it depends on the editor's taste. There's definitely very literary YA. I've read some very like esoteric literary YA, and it's all taste. You know, and I think even the Big Five release stuff like that. It's not common to see it necessarily, but I think as we're coming out with more contemporary stories, and I think YA is being taken more seriously by the general public now than it used to be like 10 years ago. I think editors are like, we can finally start to publish these complex, difficult, nuanced stories because kids want them and kids understand them. So you're seeing a lot of those books come out now in the last like 5 years, which is really exciting because I know like the history of YA is kind of spotty and not always good. There's like some classic seminal titles, but the results are like really corny ones or like after school special books or the Go Ask Alice book that was written by an anonymous teenager, written by the editor. And, you know, this is a real story and it's still selling. And now I think editors and houses are like, okay, but kids aren't buying that and neither are their parents. So it's like, they're reading it and they're like, this is corny. So they want more books that are weird and take risks.
Well, and I think that some of the biggest titles in the last decade or 15 years have been young adult books.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, there has just been some really great young adult fiction. And I don't read all of it. I read some of it. You know, when it comes to my door, I read it. But there is just some really fantastic young adult stuff, especially compared to when I was a kid. You know,
we were reading adult books at that point.
Yeah, exactly. Because we didn't have anything that wasn't childish, but that wasn't completely adult. We didn't have anything we could really relate to. Right. So I think it's a great thing for the market for young adult to be kind of taking center stage the way it is.
Yeah. And there's this common understanding that kids like to read up. Like if it's a 15-year-old kid, they like to read about kids in college or in their senior year of high school because you always sort of want to read up a little bit. And that's true for younger kids too. So I think that's part of why we're also seeing more college YA come out, which I'm very excited about. I love college YA. I'm always so frustrated there's not enough of it because that is such an important time period for so many people. And YA is all about identity and like your freshman year identity. Like that's huge. And unfortunately, most of it's still in high school.
Isn't that where, sorry, not to interrupt though, but
no, it's fine.
We have YA and then we have NA.
New adult. I don't think anybody's like exactly sure what new adult is.
Yeah,
it because kind of blends into romance.
Like it's that college age.
Yes, but a lot not of times really. NA is still going to have probably some sex in it. And that's, you know.
If you think back to what we were reading when we were that age, you know, and when it came to sex, you almost just glossed over it sometimes and just got to the good story, get to the plot. At least that's how I would read when I was that age.
I think new adult, and I'm not an expert on this, but I think it started as something and then it sort of just became like a romance sort of subcategory in a way, because for like young adults, I don't know where new adult is going. There's a lot of mixed opinions on what it is, but I think expanding what we define as YA is more helpful because I think having early college stories would still work, but that's just me. Because I think people think young adult and some people think childish. And I'm like, but there's so many stories. I mean, most of them aren't childish at all. At the end of the day, people are like, what makes this a young adult book? And I'm like, marketing. It's just, that's how they market it. So.
Well, how old is Jack, your main character?
He's 17.
Okay.
Yeah, that falls into young adult by just age.
Right, just a hair. And I picked that age because he's like, you know, not yet a man, still a boy. It's that kind of like, ooh, what do I do? Because he's thinking about graduation and he's thinking about his life after high school. And that's a big part of the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, see, the whole
You've been working on defining this yourself.
I have, because when I write a character who's 25 and just out of college, mm-hmm. my mind goes straight to adult, but it's still in that early stage of adulthood. You know, it's that first freedom, you know, first job, things like that. Mm-hmm. So to me, that falls into young adult, but not really young adult as in kids. It's still new adult, but it's not romance either. So it's like, where does young adult and new adult stop and end?
Well,
because in my mind, when I hear young adult, and I know that's not the definition, when I hear young adult, I think high school kids.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think, you know, like the young adults, you know. Yeah. The
well, that is the target demographic is high school kids, like 13, well, 18.
And when I think of young adult, and I'm probably in the minority here, but I think of more of the writing style. And I think of young adult as easier for me to digest the words. It's often not overly laden with excess description that I really don't need. It's telling me about the character. It's telling me about the story. And I don't have all the extra junk that I don't necessarily want. It's easy for me to process.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that. You know, when I wrote Pathosis and Ecocide, they are adult stories, but written in more of a young adult style, I think. There's a lot of violence in them. There's no sex in them. There's very little cussing in them. But I wanted to write it in a style that would be accessible to anyone that wanted to read them, from, you know, a 13, 14, 15-year-old to somebody my age. And still tell a really cool story, you know, an apocalyptic zombie kind of story, but not have it be overburdened with junk that just didn't need to be in there.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. I think everyone has a different opinion on what makes young adult. It's so fascinating, but I just want that to continue to expand. I like that the definition's expanding and including more things. And now there's more literary YA and more, not that commercial YA is bad at all, but I think we're seeing a blend of different genres too, which is really interesting. We're seeing like magical realism horror, and we're seeing like historical fantasy, and we're seeing a lot of things that are exciting because they're not just one thing.
For sure. Now, what is the retelling that you're going to be working on?
I'm not sure if I should say this. I've said it on Twitter.
Well, you are live, so don't say it if you don't want to say it.
No, I should say it. It's going to be a queer retelling of Thelma Louise, and it's a young adult retelling. See, okay. Every time I say that, I get that reaction, which is why I know I should write it. Every time some people, they're like, oh, yeah, and they get really excited because everyone knows Thelma Louise. Even if they haven't seen the movie, they're familiar with it. So
we were just hiking in a canyon today, and I shit you not, there's 130-foot cliffs going above us. And there's this pieces of this busted up car wedged going down along the cliffs. And I was like, it's Thelma and Louise's car. That's all it is. That's why it's there.
Exactly. So, it's so part of our culture. It's so ingrained. And I just think it's such an interesting thing to retell. I think I'm not going to spoil too much about what I'm doing, but I want to do like a new take on the text. So I'm going to have to watch the movie a lot and read a lot of books about the movie and all kinds of stuff.
Well, just hearing you say that, I mean, I almost get goosebumps because I can 100% picture this retelling, and you could go in a lot of different directions mm-hmm. with it. But looking at, I can totally picture it, and I can totally picture it being a fantastic read because, yeah, just and I wouldn't want to get too deep into it because for those of you out there who haven't seen the movie, go watch the movie. It's a fantastic movie. Mm-hmm. What is it? Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon. Is that
mm-hmm.
who it is? Anyhow, fantastic movie. Not only about female empowerment, but about all the oppression and shit that all of us have to deal with in our day-to-day lives and how that can be completely overwhelming. But I think that will be a real winner.
Thank you. I hope so too. But what's interesting about Thelma and Louise is, and this is just going into film, but like I'm also a film nerd, but like I feel like there haven't been a lot of movies like that since. That was like a very groundbreaking feminist film that was just about women and a road trip. And we don't see a lot of movies like that now. I think that was kind of a one-off in a sense in Hollywood in the sense of Hollywood, maybe not indies.
Didn't Britney Spears make an award-winning road trip movie? Crossroads?
Probably, yeah. I don't think it's one of
those. I'm kidding. I have no idea. I remember seeing the trailer.
I know you're kidding. No, but I don't think we've seen anything as distinctly feminist and in your face and like that since Thelma. I think Thelma Louise, at least it's been as big as Thelma Louise. So...
yeah, it was a good movie.
That's one reason I want to bring the story back, because I want to explore the patriarchy through the eyes of these teenage girls who are just like, screw men, and they just want to go do their own thing. And I think that it just sounds fun.
Smash it the does. Patriarchy.
It sounds like a great read.
I mean, I hope I write it well. There's a lot, people are all excited now, and I'm just like, okay, now I have to write it. I have like 1,000 words so far.
Sit down every day. Make your 1,000
words a day.
Word spew, no self-editing.
Don't mess it up, Julia. I'm expecting
will, don't worry. But it's fine.
It to be very messy.
You know, all my drafts are messy, and I'm okay with that. But I'm so self-conscious when I'm writing usually. I don't know. I think it's part of being a writer. You're just so self-aware. You're just so in your head. It's really hard to get out of that. Yeah. And when you read a lot, you don't want it to like directly influence anything you're writing now. So you're also kind of thinking, you're like, is this a copy of what I just read? Or did I lift that word or that visual? Yeah.
Well, we are getting about the end of our time here. Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about or let the viewers know before we go, Julia?
I just wanted to let the viewers know that if they could request my book at their local library, that would be extremely helpful. It's easy and free, and it's something I'm pushing now because this is a book that I want kids from all backgrounds to read who might not have an Amazon account or be able to afford, you know, a Kindle book or a paperback. So if, you know, and the more libraries this gets in, the better for the book. I think this is a book that needs to be in libraries. So that's my plug. I really hope people request this book. And if you want to read it, enjoy it, if not, just request it at your local library, and that will really help me.
And we'll make sure to post a link in the description below this video so that way that the viewers who show up after the fact, they can find your links and find ways to get to your book.
Yes. And you can follow me on Twitter at julialynrubin.com. It's just JULIALYNNRUBIN. I almost couldn't spell my name.
That was good.
Yeah. And then you can find me at julialynrubin.com. I'm very active on Twitter. And yeah, just tweet me. I like to talk. So.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It has been wonderful to have you and to learn a little bit about what you do. So we're gonna sign off for the night. And I'm Jason. This is Katie. Thanks for watching, everybody.
Thank you. Remember to subscribe for updates for future shows that we do. And feel free to like and share with everyone. Yes.
I did notice your pug shirt. I was going to point it out and I forgot.
Thank you again, Julia, for hanging out with us this week.
Thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.
Definitely.
Right. Have a good night.
You too.
Thank you for listening to Spilling Ink.